Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We do not have a lot of time, so let me just dive straight into the show. Is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. We have an awesome interview with a South Dakota state representative. He got elected last term and was his first term serving, and he's running for re-election. And based on this interview and based on our conversation and based on his support for legislation in this past session, this guy's solid. I'd like to think that this is the Thomas Jefferson of South Dakota. I've reached out to a lot of different conservatives, but it seems like this guy really gets it, and he understands the importance of protecting his constituents from tyranny. He understands what the heck's going on. He has a lot of conservative, I'll just say he's in a conservative position where he wants to do a lot of things. And we're going to cover that in this upcoming interview. But I just want you to understand this one thing, that sometimes with the best intentions, we're willing to do something that might be contrary to the actual Constitution and some of those things that we actually are trying to keep people from being harmed with arbitrary legislation, rules, and so forth. So anyway, as we kind of discuss just a few issues, you're going to see, you'll hear the light clicking, like an epiphany. Oh, you know, that absolutely makes sense. And I'll just say this. I was at a point, and I think I've lent to this in a previous conversation. I've been at a point where not finding more good constitutional conservatives is really deflating. And having this conversation with this state representative really, as I expressed, I think, in the last segment, it really buoyed my spirits. And it really helped put some wind in my sails. And we will be right back with Representative Randolph in just a minute, right after this promo. So thank you so much, and please stay tuned. You're going to want to hear this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open. First off, I appreciate you taking the time. I secondly appreciate your service. And third, I sent you that article because you were involved in some legislation that I believe Representative Johnson had sponsored, basically regarding constitutional enforcement.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah.
And so, if you couldn't tell by the articles I sent you, I'm huge on constitutional enforcement.
Yes, indeed, I love that. And thank you for sending me those articles. I got halfway through the second one you sent me, and I'll say, as I was reading through the first, I got to a certain point, and I was hoping that it wasn't going to be at the end a pitch for Article 5. And I read farther, and as I read, I realized, no, this is not a pitch for Article 5. It's not that I don't believe that the Article 5 is valid. I'm not on board, I guess you would say. It's not that I'm for or against the Article 5 movement.
Right.
The Article 5 was put in there on purpose. And
if I could just interrupt you real quick, because I'm a student of this. At this point in time when the Constitution was being written, they didn't have the concept of auditing contracts. Their level of understanding contract law had not matured to like what it is today.
Mm.
And so they never, I mean, even though the term audit had existed maybe in England and so forth, auditing and contract auditing, because pretty much back in those days, a contract was done by a handshake.
Right.
Yes. And so auditing was kind of left for the functional facets of finance and accounting and those types of things.
Gotcha.
So the concept of coming up and saying, hey, where is this power delegated to you in the Constitution? If you really look, and that's why that whole article I sent you kind of pointed out that Jefferson actually did an audit, but he just verbally counted off how these acts that were passed, the Sedition and Alien Acts, how they violated both the Bill of Rights and the Constitution.
Right.
And all I did was I extrapolated, and actually, to be honest, this was a whole new concept for me. And I thought it was an original thought, but as I started studying, I realized that what I was calling for was identically aligned with what Jefferson and Madison had done in 1798.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Well, you know, I've had conversations, many conversations, from those who are opposed to and those who are proponents of the Article 5 movement, and there's a clear line between the two. As I've said, you know, which was pointed out in the article, there's nothing wrong with our Constitution. Our Constitution is just fine. And the Founding Fathers did a fantastic job of laying this out. I had not read in times past the arguments as far as against the Bill of Rights, but that makes perfect sense in that the fear being if you begin to spell certain rights out, then there are those in the future who may take that as, well, these are what your rights are, and the rest we can decide.
Right, and so you're referencing, I think, the second article.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, which is, I'm actually writing a fourth really critical article for our time, and it's regarding Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Mm.
And you probably don't know really what it says or what it really means because nobody ever teaches this. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment points to, if you understand the whole, the genesis behind the 14th Amendment, and there's good organizations out there that have kind of clung to what I prove in the very first article regarding interposition and nullification. And I'll just point to the 10th Amendment Center, and they're huge on nullification. And the fact of the matter is that they're also huge on the concept of the incorporation concept of the incorporation clause of the 14th Amendment, where you've probably read that the 14th Amendment actually incorporated the Bill of Rights into the restrictions upon the states.
Right. Yes.
And so the 10th Amendment Center doesn't buy into that. There's a lot of groups that don't buy into that. And if you understand the whole, and this is where I was going to, but I wanted to create this kind of background. If you understand that at the time, the whole purpose of the 14th Amendment was to secure the liberties of the freemen, because at that point in time, the South was deliberately oppressing. I mean, now that they had just lost the war, and right. and they had no other place to go other than back into the Union.
Mm-hmm.
They started actually, you know, what do losers do? They try to, you know, go around ways of you know, hurting those people that they've wanted to hurt. And so they started passing laws of assembly, right to bear arms, and those types of things that oppressed the freemen. So the 14th Amendment, the whole purpose of this was to ensure that the freemen were protected.
Right, right. Yes, exactly.
And if you look at the history books, the North actually went into the South, and so at that same point in time, this is where reparations were, I think, propagated. The concept of reparations were coming from the Northern military men that were coming down. I didn't want to call them militia, because the militia actually failed, and the militia was disbanded. Right. For the Civil War, but and that's important, because that other article that you haven't read, you need to kind of understand that too. But the most important part here is that the 14th Amendment was designed to, one, protect and secure the liberties of the freemen, and secondly, it was to go after, it identified what citizenship was as well. And maybe third was to go after those who rebelled against the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
because they recognize, and this is Section 3, they recognize that the South deliberately went and violated the Constitution. And so they created this teeth instead of, you know, you just are going to be considered an immoral person because you violate your oath and you're not supporting, because there was no teeth in supporting the oath of office. And so the third section actually identifies teeth, and it basically makes it very easy, because it creates a criteria of qualification. When you read it, you'll start to understand that no person can be a public servant if you take an oath and you violate that oath by supporting rebellion against the Constitution. And and this whole paradigm is brand new to most people, because they've just never discovered this. People just don't read these types of things.
Right.
And so this section has languished for well over 150 years. And it becomes, I believe, the weapon that you can use within the state legislature and within the state to go after any public servant who is deliberately supporting any type of efforts that are contrary to the Constitution, like trying to implement democracy and or trying to implement socialism or granting powers that aren't delegated, those types of things. So anyway, I didn't mean to cut you off. What, you had something to say?
Oh, no, that's okay. I think I like the way this is flowing anyway. I'm appreciative of the articles you've sent me. And it's inspiring me to dig some more, because I had never thought about that from that standpoint. And so this is very, very, you're definitely teaching me some things here, which I am so appreciative of, because I do think that we've lost sight of the original intent, what the boundaries are supposed to be, and the fact that, like in the articles, you've spoken that it's the state's job to maintain the boundaries and remind Congress when they step outside of it, when the federal government steps outside of its boundaries, right, which are contained by the Constitution, then it is our job as the states to remind them of that and take the necessary steps to pressure them back into those boundaries.
That's correct.
I'm very thankful for the articles and also the elimination of Article 14, because I had not seen that, nor, like you said, have been taught that. These are things that are not definitely not being taught in school, and there's really no one digging into them that I know of past, you know, I'm sure there's some others besides you, but you've really done a lot of homework on this. So I'm thankful to have conversation with you and to listen and learn to some of these things. So thank you.
No, it's my pleasure to serve. This is how I serve. And believe it or not, because a lot of people have asked me to run. I live in a technically it's now a blue state. It was a purple state, and it used to be a red state. It became a purple state and now a solid blue state because they implemented voter ballots. Every state that implements mail-in ballot, in other words, they shut down the local precincts where people go and get recognized by their neighbors. Oh, hey, how you doing? And that type of thing. Right. And they dismantle that and force everybody to start mailing in. Miraculously, the state turns blue because they use algorithms and a computer to actually tabulate, you know, how the votes are cast. And by doing so, it gives them reasons to completely redo the actual ballot. And so they can actually predict what precincts they want to focus on, like really dark red precincts. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll just say, oh, well, for some reason, this ballot couldn't be read, so we rewrote it. And there is no transparency in the process. And so if there's a big push in South Dakota, because I know there is in Wyoming, for creating a mail-in ballot system, let me know, because I can give you some real subject matter experts to tell you why it is the most nefarious implementation of our system, because it removes truly the transparency and checks and balances. But anyway, the reason I was calling, or actually calling upon you, was one, the efforts that you had. I don't know if Representative Johnson is going to survive his off time and get reelected, because I understand he's in a pretty heated race. And I did notice that you, along with, I believe, two other Republicans that I have not been able to reach out to, really kind of got involved in this one piece of legislation. And I'm hoping that as you read these articles, that legislation it opens the door to allow the state of South Dakota to begin auditing the Constitution, because it's all about enforcing the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And that's your job, believe it or not. You know, if you guys did nothing, if you guys created no legislation in the next couple of years and only enforced the Constitution, you would probably find that life in South Dakota would be getting better.
Yeah, I would agree. I've made that statement several times to different colleagues, that I would love to show up for session in January and have no bills that we're planning to take up, but simply go through our codified law right now and do the different things that we need to do to remove things that are that should not be in there. And as you said, go through those things that help us uphold the original Constitution rather than just passing more and more laws. I mean, you know, 500 some odd bills that come through every year, and obviously not every one of them make it, but I mean, how many more laws do we need?
So I have a very simplified version of what you guys had. And lawyers like to complicate things. I hope you're not a lawyer.
No, I'm an electrical contractor.
Oh, okay, good.
I'm a working guy.
Oh, okay. So lawyers tend to like to complicate things and use, you know, fine print and, you know, big words and what have you. And I've been known to use a couple of big words every once in a while, but I believe in simplicity, and I think that's the exact same thing that the framers believed in. And so the law that I introduced, the bill that I proposed to Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho and a couple of other states, was this simple, that all laws within the state of blank, whether they be statutes, you know, laws and or whatever you guys use for terms of regulations, codes, what have you. You just kind of list that laundry list of any enforceable law must comply with the U.S. and the state constitution. That simple. Because if you pass that, then what happens is then the body of the legislature then should say, after you pass that, well, do we have any laws that are violating the U.S. Constitution? And it instantly opens up the door for auditing. And then the epiphany would come, well, hold it, before we can really start with us, because you're going to find out that there are many things that the state does that's required by the federal government, like Environmental Protection Agency laws and or so forth. The same thing with education, same thing with health care. But guess what? In this one particular law, it actually allows you to shift your focus and look at the federal government and audit them, just like what Jefferson did, and literally call them out and say, where did we delegate this power to you to do this, 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 and this? And you can create this laundry list. And as you begin to understand the limitations of the federal government's jurisdiction, I want you to grasp this one thing. As Madison stated this, and as Nicholas and even Marshall stated this, the federal government's jurisdiction is limited to the enumerated powers within that Constitution.
Right.
In other words, even though they may have the ability to view cases between states or citizens between states or what have you, it doesn't open the door for them to create any law that is not within their enumerated powers.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
In other words, marriage. Mm-hmm. In other words, life.
Yep.
They have zero jurisdiction. It's one thing for them to make a ruling, but the Supreme Court, unless you can show me the amendment, any ruling... Fine. Any ruling only determines the outcome of a case. It does not create law.
Right, right. And, you know, there's two things I want to that is a conversation I have all over the place. And I had that several times this past session. A bill that I actually brought forth was, it was called House Bill 1215. And House Bill 1215 did, it was going to work in three areas. One, it was requiring our government, South Dakota state government, to only recognize the marriage between one man and one woman. And it, well, we weren't going to recognize the pronouns, and we weren't going to go down that whole road. And we also were not going to create the protected group that has to do with the LGBT, right? So there was that. There was, what was the second part? That might have been the second. Oh, the second part of it had to do with recognize or not recognizing the pronouns and that sort of stuff, kind of going down that portion of it. And then it was also doing away with the for whatever reason, I just lost the term they used, but the library story hour, where the drag queen story hour, I think they call it.
Yes. Uh huh. Go ahead.
It was dealing with that one as well. That was not allowed. So anyway, as you can imagine, the bill caught quite a bit of heat. I got lots and lots and lots of phone calls and emails and text messages and that sort of stuff. Me being a hater and all of the names that come up with all of that. So, but it also opened up conversations with several of those in the gay community. And at Cracker Barrels, I would have groups come up and basically try to corner, but I'm not afraid of them. So let's have a conversation. I'd love to talk to you about why I brought this and why I believe the way I believe and the foundation I have for it. So anyway, many times they would bring up Obergefell. And I would remind them that, well, the Supreme Court was never designed never given the authority to make law. So any opinion that they come forth with is that. It's an opinion. Until Congress decides that they want to take it up and try and create a law about it, it's just an opinion of the court. So therefore, South Dakota is not bound by the Obergefell ruling. Neither is it bound by, and I would throw this in, neither is it bound by the Roe versus Wade ruling. Why? Because it's not law, it's opinion. And they didn't like that answer and would try to dispute it, but they don't really have any. I mean, if you honestly are going to follow what the Constitution is and you're trying to say that you have the constitutional right that to marry the same person of the same or same, someone of the same sex, and you're saying this is, you know, and we're following the Constitution, well, if you really want to follow the Constitution, then let's go back to what the Constitution was really designed for, and then we can start from there. But if you want to start from here and kind of move the line and say, well, this is where we start from, well, now you've obscured it, and we're not the same nation anymore if you do that. Right. We're susceptible to everything.
Right, right. And so you were already kind of in the right mind model. And now the information I've given you has actually made you more powerful.
Yes. Absolutely.
My intent is to make you and those like you that recognize the tyranny we're living under, mm-hmm. to be the Thomas Jeffersons of tomorrow. To actually, the term I use is reframer or the restorers of our constitutional republic, because you're spot on. First off, the one thing I wanted to, and I was kind of concerned because I wasn't sure, because we'd never talked before, and I knew in that first article I come right out and point out that the Civil Rights Act is unconstitutional. Now, right. it is constitutional within the District of Columbia, because right. Congress has full legislative powers over the District of Columbia. And,
yes.
And by the way, for the fact that Washington, D.C. has a mayor and has any form of government without amending the Constitution and taking away the exclusive legislative powers, that is unconstitutional. I'm not sure if you understood this.
No, well, I'd never thought about it, but it obviously makes perfect sense, yes.
Right. So the only way they could actually create a city mayor and city council and give them legislative powers is they must amend Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, to take away the exclusive legislative power. The reason why they've never done that is because they've tried to use that with this concept that, oh, well, we have exclusive legislative powers for the entire country. And I can prove to you through the ratification debates, I can give you all sorts of citations to prove otherwise, that those powers were only granted for the District of Columbia only. Now, putting that into perspective, because like I said, I didn't know how you were going to take the Civil Rights Act, because, you know, I actually view the Civil Rights Act as a noble thing, but that's a state responsibility, and we right. don't want the federal government to be the ones dictating that. I mean, right. I've always been, you know, for most of my life, I thought the Bill of Rights, I thought everything that the federal government was doing was good. And then as I started really learning Madison's position on the Bill of Rights and all the rest of the framers that you had seen and how they argued against it, I go, you know what? The Bill of Rights were clearly a very dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. But there was wisdom or providence within the Bill of Rights. And the fact of the matter is the Bill of Rights very rarely were ever trampled on until the Civil War and the 14th Amendment. And so I saw the providence in having the Bill of Rights for the application of them to the states. Now, see, you got to understand, I think I made it pretty clear. If I hadn't, as you read through, it'll become a little more clear that the Bill of Rights, or I should say the 14th Amendment, only applies the individual privileges and individual immunities that are within the Bill of Rights. In other words, and I think in one of the articles I state the case that a state And at that time, during the Bill of Rights, states actually had state-sponsored churches.
Right, yes.
The essence was that the federal government could not create a state-sponsored church.
Right.
The Bill of Rights, as it was applied via the 14th Amendment, it did not apply or make it illegal for the states to maintain having a state-sponsored church.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Because it doesn't deny an individual privilege or immunity, it is organizational in kind. And here's the other thing, because there's one other organizational thing within the Bill of Rights that is protected, and that's called the freedom of the press. The states actually can create laws. Just so you know, you can create standards for your journalism and actually fine journalists if they actually want to just grind an axe. And if you create standards and say you must be objective, you must show, you know, the pros and cons and what have you of everything that you want to, you know, like if you want to do an article on guns, you have to throw out all three sides, you know, the objective, the pro, and the con. And that way people can, you know, actually start reading objective journalism. That would be great, and that would literally put the Constitution to the test, because, and there's no doubt in my mind, as the states move forward, these are paradigm changes, because most people just think that the sanctity of the press is unquestionable.
Right.
That's only with the federal government. And the fact is that the press has been getting away with becoming the propaganda machine for global communism for years and years. And even David Rockefeller pointed that out in 1991 or two, when he came out and said, you know, for 50 years, we have to thank you because you've helped our agenda in creating a new world order. I think he actually used those terms.
Wow.
And he made that comment to the Council of Foreign Relations with the primary leaders of the press, like the New York Times and so forth, were present. And so I'm just trying to, you know, give you this kind of background. And now we're getting into Soji laws, marriage, and everything else. The fact of the matter is, and if you want my advice and help, the smartest thing a state can do is a state needs to just make a comment that marriage, if you look at the origins of the word marriage, that's a religious word.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so there are other words for, you know, unions and so forth. The smartest thing a state can do is a state should cease and desist all marriages and marriage licenses, that every religion must come up with their own. That and the only thing that the state should maybe do is, you know, create a common union type of law, that if you live together for a duration of however many years, then that is, in the eyes of this state, viewed as a common union. And you know, if all of a sudden you separate, then there is case, or, you know, we will support the equal, you know, severing of property and so forth. But stepping away completely from marriage all of a sudden takes it away from you having to protect anything, and you leave it to the churches and you leave it to the business to come up with how they want to manage it.
That makes perfect sense to me. That makes perfect sense to me. I had a few bills this year that, not surprisingly did not get anywhere, but I had another bill. I can't remember what the name of it was. It was 1235. Anyway, basically the bill was doing away with no fault divorce. And,
oh yeah, that's a dangerous one.
I my goal with it, it was kind of like a start. It's like, okay, here's where we are. And I, just like you said, the idea of government being involved in defining marriage or marriage period and that sort of stuff, having anything to do with it, I've always thought that was wrong. So I thought, okay, I'm going to pick a place, I'm going to start, and I'm going to see if I can't walk some of this back. And so that was kind of the start, the doing away with no fault divorce. And that was in conversation, same thing that I had with different people. It's, well, this is where I'm at. This is the start. And I hope, you know, my goal would be to walk this back to where we as a state, our government has absolutely nothing to do with marriage, and it puts it back in its proper place. And, of course, it didn't. It failed in committee, but, and I thank God for this, that I wasn't exactly sure how I was going to present it, because I was trying to come up with different statistics and things like that. And when it was all said and done, I only used very few statistics, but just simply used the statistics of humans and painted the picture of why, you know, how everyone has dealt with it, whether personally or, you know, they know someone, they have a brother, sister, a friend, whatever, who's been through divorce, they've seen the devastation in the kids, things like that. And I laid all of that out. And when it was all said and done, and I lay this to the favor of God, is that when it was all said and done, the committee really didn't know what to do with it. When it came time for them to talk about it, they didn't know what to say. And so it did what it was supposed to do. It still failed, but it did what it was supposed to do. But all of that just to, you know, to give God glory and to say that would be something that I would really love to be able to do. And maybe the way to go about it is just more directly, like you said, and just simply come up with something that cuts government out of it altogether. I don't know. I guess we'd have to talk about that a little bit more to see the best course of action for it.
Well, so if you understand the framers' paradigm, there were two objects of government: protecting life is primary, mm-hmm. and protecting property is secondary. Mm-hmm. Those are the two objects of government. Mm-hmm. And so, bottom line, the only time government should ever get involved in unions, whether that be, you know, business unions or civil unions such as marriage or what have you, is the process of the divorce. Mm. And most of that should be left to, and so this is where it gets good, if you wash your hands of it. And I believe that government should really wash their hands of as much domestic stuff that they have no business doing.
Right.
Welfare. Turn welfare back to the churches. The reason we're in the situation today, and I can give you the history of Christianity in America. I wrote a book about it, but that's not the whole point here. The point is that in the 1820s, the evangelical movement changed Christianity. It was the Second Awakening. And what ended up happening was the evangelical movement brought money into the picture for Christianity, for the new formed Christianity. Because the old form, the old world form, was established churches in countries or states. Mm-hmm. And so if you understand, England had its own church, France had its own church, and there were no other churches before them.
Right.
You were committing heresy if you divided, and that's why the Puritans, that's why a part of America was, you know, created, such as the New England side and so forth, Pennsylvania, was for religious freedom. But all of America wasn't designed and it wasn't established because of religious freedom. That was just one of the things. It was economic opportunity. Virginia and the southern states were primarily economic opportunity type of things until all of a sudden, and I think it was in the 1660s, when slavery became the law of the land. In other words, blacks were relegated to slaves, because prior to that, I believe it was all the way up into the 1830s, where indentured servants, black, didn't matter what, they, right. After 7 years, they were free. That's why there were freemen that were actually voting in the 16 and 1700s, black freemen. And it was in the South where they started deliberately, you know, going. And as a matter of fact, if you're familiar with the Declaration of Independence, and the original version. Thomas Jefferson points out that it was the design of the crown of the king to, you know, take a, you know, a class and race of people and bring them there and consign them to a life of slavery. And so it was a political design, because you also have to understand that even at that point in time, when we came here for economic freedom, we still didn't have economic freedom because we lived under a mercantile system.
Right.
Our economy was managed by government. The government would dictate what you had to grow to sell. You could still grow stuff for yourself, but you couldn't sell it per se. They would tell you what you could sell. Almost like, and so when they ask people, what is our economy based on today? And most people say, oh, we got a free market. And I go, no, we don't. We actually have a mercantile system. Because if all of a sudden you want to actually start getting into this, you have to have, you know, these certain certifications. I mean, state government and federal government create all these barriers that to get into a certain level of business, you already have to be well established, because they've created these protections in their relationships with business. And I'm sure you can appreciate that. But anyway, I digress. The intent here is to try to, you know, cast this paradigm of saying, well, government should probably not be involved in religious things, even though at one point in time we had state governments. The reason we got away from the church is taking care of welfare is, again, because the evangelicals wanted to keep their money. What happened, and I'll forgive me for diving into it, but because I was getting there, but I didn't. During the Second Awakening, the evangelical troops started forming, and they would go from one town to another town, and they would have these great shows with snake oil and, you know, healing and so forth, and people would just be amazed, and they would give their money, and then the troop would go to the next town and to the next town. And by the time bad luck befell upon the town, well, who were the people, who were these people supposed to go to? They were the parishioners of another church, so they'd go to their way leader and they'd go, well, I didn't get any money because everybody gave it to that troop that just left town. And so how was it that the churches were able to take care of their own? And they started having to compete because they didn't own that. And so as Christianity became professionalized, where people became, you know, professional preachers, and that's how they made their money, all of a sudden, it, you know, I'll just say it perverted the entire system. But bottom line, states used to have state-sponsored churches, and we got away from that because the secular movement in the middle of the 1800s started saying, hey, you know, you're telling me that I have to go to a church to get, you know, help? How come you can't give us help? Right. And they started pressing those boundaries, and it was the godless who actually created. And I make the argument, and I think you'll find it a very interesting article. It's about 30-some pages. I'm breaking it up into three. But I make the argument that the federal government and even state governments are culpable in creating the Antichrist church. Because that's exactly what we have done, is we have gone after Christianity. The federal government does not allow any form of Christianity in the public arena, and they go after prayer in public and so forth. In other words, thou shalt not have any other god before the great secular godlessness of the federal government.
Yeah.
If that starts to make sense, then the smartest thing states should do is actually back out and then leave it to the communities and the churches to take care of one, education, take care of health care, take care of welfare, and all those types of things. If all of a sudden we went back, and it would take a little bit of time, and states would have to actually get involved. And the way I would do it, if, and again, GR is not king, but I've had lots of these conversations. The way I would do it is I would create a free market amongst the different Christian faiths. Okay, so in the state of South Dakota, you may have Catholics, Baptists, Lutherans, Episcopals, probably got some Mormons, Evangelicals, and so forth. And you say, you know what? Okay, you faiths, we're going to take the money instead of actually handing it out. We're going to give this money per apportionment to the organizations so that, you know, if you're not a Christian organization, you want to create a community organization, then we're going to basically give you a little bit of the assistance so everybody can administer these compassionate services.
Mm-hmm.
And it will force the godless secularist, atheist, or what have you, to start getting, you know, working together and taking care of each other instead of saying, go get it because you're entitled to it from government.
Right.
Secondly, it will also prove to the state that over time, certain churches will be far more efficient, and you will start being able to dictate, you need to follow this model. You need to follow that model. You know, for education, you need to follow this model over here of how the Jesuits do it, or welfare. You need to follow how the Mormons do this over here. And actually, you can then start forcing improvements instead of people being able to game the system. Because if the intent is that compassionate services are only there as an essential time of need, then the intent is, and I think the foundation throughout our core society should be self-reliance.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
If that is not the goal of compassionate services, then and of course there's always going to be the widow. There's always going to be the person that may be lame for life, disabled, or what have you. There'll always be those. But there is no excuse for capable, able-bodied people to be sitting in the Social Security Department trying to game their disabilities and ways of getting over on the system.
That makes perfect sense. And I've always said, and I believe this is true, that the churches are best able to determine who is doing what and where they're at. Because that face-to-face, we'll use example. On the street corner, you see someone who's willing to work for food. Well, it's easy to test that.
Yeah, give them a job.
Yep, exactly. And if they don't want to take it, or I've heard stories of people who say they've gotten mad at them. They screamed at them for offering them work. Well, that wasn't their intention. And the majority, that's not their intention. There are probably a few. I've come across a couple situations where there's a guy on the corner, and he basically had the sign that says, my family and I, we ran out of gas, we need this, we're trying to head here, and so forth and so on. So I stopped. I said, hey, I'll meet you over at the gas station and we'll get you some gas. So got him over there, filled up his tank. I gave him, after talking with him, I realized, well, this is definitely a legitimate situation. And so I had some cash in my pocket and I gave it to him. And then there was somebody else that, must have witnessed it, and they came back out of the store with food, not cash, but food for the family and things of that nature. And, you know, but we were able to discern that by the face-to-face.
Right.
But that's how it's supposed to be. The government setting up its guidelines on how you get welfare, how you're supposed to qualify for food stamps. Well, all they're looking at is, well, if you meet the qualifications, or if you seem to, well, then you'll get the money. So, and again, that takes it away from that being able to actually lend a helping hand, actually be able to minister to people the way we're supposed to. And that has been one of the greatest, just like you said, it government becoming God rather than God being God, and the individual believers being able to minister to other individual citizens and help them out of their situations, giving them clear foundations to stand upon and to better themselves.
Right, absolutely. Representative, if you could really hold on, because what I want to do is I want to kind of take a pause, and then I want to initiate a second round for recording. This has been a great conversation, and I hope I'm not encroaching too much upon your time. but there's actually something I really wanted to talk to you about one, both the election and what's going on in the country and so forth. So
with that, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to have a promo because I can actually see that we're actually right out of time. So we're going to finish this interview with Representative Randolph when we come back in our next episode. But I'm going to wrap things up for this show right after this promo coming up. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so you can tell that this man definitely has a slant towards individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and recognizes, I'll just say, the trappings of trying to do things or trying to use legislative cures to try to fix problems, that ensuring that we try to invoke laws that embrace liberty and getting government out of the business of regulating so many facets of our own lives. Folks, we will be back with even more information we have another follow-up in our next episode. As you can tell, we really haven't gotten to the meat of where we need to go and leadership and how this great representative can actually lead within the state of South Dakota and actually begin leading with other states as well and working with other states as well. So with that, in our next episode, we'll do the wrap-up of the interview, and I'm hoping that you understand the importance of this stuff. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.